sunny and warm, a high of 73, inland 61 near Lake Michigan, with some very high winds possible. And then Friday night, high winds, some thunderstorms possible. They are saying, the National Weather Service, we could see a tornado, and that's going to be Friday night. Saturday, partly sunny, windy and warm, a chance of rain, a high of 63. To ramp up the weekend, Sunday, partly sunny and seasonal, slight chance of morning rain or snow showers, a high of 42. Current stats, wind calm, 31 degrees Racine, 32 in Kenosha. Now, 10 minutes after 8, the morning show with Greg Berg on the way next.
And we welcome you to the Thursday morning show on WGTD. I'm Gregory Berg. We have two novelists as guests today. Part one, a newly recorded interview. The other, from the morning show archives, an interview recorded back in 2009. Here's part one. I am so pleased to be able to spend the next few minutes of WGTD's morning show talking with an outstanding playwright and screenwriter and now novelist, Kevin Wade. It is very likely that you have experienced his great work in his screenplays such as Working Girl, True Colors, Meet Joe Black, Made in Manhattan, and on television in particular, the wonderful CBS drama Blue Bloods that came to a close not too long ago, starring Tom Selleck. And Kevin Wade has now turned his considerable writing talents to his first novel, which is called Johnny Careless. And in the wake of the wonderful police procedural Blue Bloods, it's not a surprise that this particular novel also centers on the work of police. And in particular, one specific policeman, police chief Jeep Mullane, and the difficulty that he has in cracking a case that involves a very good friend of his from his past, and that search for justice and navigating very, very tricky waters is really the heart and soul of this wonderfully written novel. And I'm excited to be able to speak with Kevin Wade about it for the next few minutes. The book, by the way, is published by Celadon Books. Kevin Wade, we welcome you to the morning show.
It's very nice to be with you, and thanks for that kind introduction.
If you don't mind, I would love to just talk a little bit generally right off the bat about your interest in the work that the police do. And of course, you had a long run with the wonderful drama Blue Bloods, serving for most of its run as the show's executive producer and showrunner. And in your biography, it says backseat driver.
Yes.
And it's interesting that you rose from the ranks of just one of the writers to such a position of prominence by the second season. How exactly did that come about?
Well, I went in during the first season. They were shooting in New York, and it was maybe they were on the third or fourth episode, and someone had mentioned that they were looking for someone, especially to work closely with Tom Selleck. And I'd worked with Tom on a movie called Mr. Baseball about 20 years before, and we'd spent a month together in Japan, and I got to know him, and we got on as colleagues and as friends. And the other principal in Blue Bloods was Leonard Goldberg, a legendary Hollywood television and movie producer, who'd come up with the concept for it. So I knew Leonard and Tom, and went in and pitched my ideas for what I would do with Tom's character. The police commissioner of New York is way closer to a CEO than he is to a cop going down the alley with his gun out. That landed on friendly ears, and I started. And by the second season, I guess just Leonard had turned to me and said, "Would you mind running it?" You know, and I said, "No, I wouldn't mind running it." And I should, for your listeners, showrunner is a very nebulous term. It's almost subjective show by show. It means really just head writer. And to some extent, the ambassador between the writers and the cast. And everything else is kind of up for grabs, depending on your appetite for how many jobs you want to try to do. So when I say backseat driver with tongue in cheek, but I meant it, because I knew a little about a lot of things, and so would consult and kind of collaborate with the editors and the casting folks and really everybody involved with the show.
Right. And you clearly have some understanding of and certainly appreciation for the important and challenging work that the police do. When I think about the kind of stories that were told on the show, one of the things that I appreciate is the way in which we get a sense of it all. The great important work of good cops, if you will, and also the presence of those in the police who are not doing the work the way it should be done and crossing certain lines that simply should not be crossed. It reminds me of kind of the frustration that I think a lot of us feel who appreciate the work of police and the importance of what they do, and we maybe want to put a sign that says "Back the Blue" in our front yard, except that sometimes the connotation of that is that we back the blue no matter what. And then when it comes to maybe difficult matters of police brutality or whatever, I mean, we do not want to go that far when it comes to backing the blue. I wonder how much you wrestle with that sort of moral or ethical conundrum in terms of how we think of ourselves in relationship with those charged with protecting us and protecting all of society.
Well, I think that it's maybe useful to delineate the purpose of a police show, a medical drama, a legal drama. The writers and the creators approach these things as story engines, rather than as any kind of political or moral validation of a particular career or job or service. So for Blue Bloods, it was really two things. We wanted to show a family who happened to be in a family business. The family business was law enforcement, whether it was as the commissioner, detectives, patrolmen, or in the case of Bridget Moynihan's character, a prosecutor with the district attorney's office. We approached, and it was a long run over 14 years, and as everybody knows, there's a lot that happens in 14 years. And involving the police, it was a particularly, shall we say, janky period in the 20-teens sometimes. And it was important to us not to be lending any kind of, like, as you pointed out, you put it well, you know, that we're backing the blue no matter what. We were backing good storytelling no matter what. And we kind of had almost a motto that if you built a soapbox for one side, and that side obviously would usually be law and order and the police, you needed to build a soapbox for the other side of equal dimensions so that the audience never felt or hopefully didn't feel like they were being preached to or taught what the proper valid point of view was, but instead we dramatize a story and hopefully you went, huh, there's both sides to that, or huh, I think that guy's completely wrong, but I understand where he comes from.
Well put, and congrats on all the great work there. What kind of a dramatic change of shift was it to write for the printed page versus writing with a printed page that would ultimately reach the screen? I mean, this wonderful novel, Johnny Careless, there are ways in which it feels somewhat cinematic. I mean, one could imagine this story perhaps living on the screen someday, and yet it lives wonderfully on the printed page as a novel. Did you feel like you were in uncharted territory or strange waters in writing in this kind of genre?
Absolutely. Really, three things popped, I'd say, the first week I was sitting at my keyboard trying to do this. One is that, as you just pointed out, screenplays, stage plays, television teleplays are not, they're not designed to be read by the reading public. They are blueprints for directors and actors and cinematographers and an entire crew of arts and crafts professionals to make something that goes up on a screen, or in the case of stage plays, obviously on the stage. So the first thing was that everything I was doing could only be, the only use was in what was on the printed page. I would not have sexy, swashbuckling, funny, charismatic actors bringing these characters to life. So it was the amount of words. If anyone's ever seen a teleplay or a stage play, you know that it's mostly white space on the page. There's a slug line as to what the scene is, where it is, and who's in it, and then a page or two of dialogue. So I was very aware of the going from 7,000 words to complete the work to 70,000 words. And in that sense, it was very much uncharted waters, but I finally calmed down enough to get some traction and eventually realized that really what I was doing was what all my collaborators had always done. I was the locations guy. I was the hair, makeup, wardrobe crew. I was the cinematographer, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. So once I settled into that, I managed to get it done.
Well put. For those of you just joining us, I'm speaking with award-winning screenwriter and playwright Kevin Wade, who is now novelist Kevin Wade. His first novel is titled Johnny Careless. And before we talk about the main character, Jeep Mullane, I want to give you a chance to talk about the fact that you set this novel on Long Island, a place I visited for the very first time this past summer. And having been there and knowing now a little bit about it, I well understand what a great choice this is. I mean, what fertile ground for a great story. But explain to our listeners why you chose Long Island as the backdrop for Johnny Careless.
Absolutely. Well, I guess first and foremost, because I live in the area, it's called the North Shore and nicknamed the Gold Coast of Long Island. I've lived here for 23 years. It's an area about 30 miles outside of New York City. And it is going back about 110 or 120 years now. You could say the North Shore is the playground of the wealthy. It was the first kind of summer colony besides the Hamptons, and it has an upstairs, downstairs, have and have nots geography to it. And I just thought that. Anytime you can find conflict outside of the character conflicts, but in this case, the cultural conflict that Jeep Mullane grew up in and now has returned to be the police chief of, felt useful. And for those of your listeners who read this, 100 years ago, F. Scott Fitzgerald published The Great Gatsby. He called it East Egg and West Egg, but it was set in the exact same locale. And it was then, as it is now, that thing, that haves and have-nots, and I just thought it was very fertile ground to begin storytelling in.
You also make an interesting choice in having your chief character, Jeep Mullane, Gerald Paul Mullane, actually, but in terms of his own background as part of a family in which law enforcement was a very strong theme, and of course that has, of course, echoes of the wonderful drama you worked on for so many, many years. Tell us more about the crafting of this central character, and in particular, where he had been, where he came from.
Sure. There's one town out here. It's a bit called Bayville, and it's called Bayville in the book. And it is the hometown for cops and firemen and plumbing supply guys. It's a more middle class, very much more middle class village surrounded by very wealthy old money, picturesque other villages. And he grew up there as the son of a cop, and he integrated through sports and through social life with the rich kids. But he had a cop for a father, and he greatly admired his father. And I think the storytelling steps off where Jeep, as most guys do who admire their fathers, you go out into the world and you try to reinvent yourself, not as your father. And so Jeep is at a period in his life where he's accepted that he's a policeman, but he has a different way of looking at it, and hopefully drawn in such a way that the reader goes, oh, he's kind of like me. You know, he's often a day late and a dollar short, and is not the expert, but he's getting up and doing the best he can every day.
Right. And the good friend of his that has been found dead, who is nicknamed Johnny Careless, and so hence the name of the novel, represents, in a sense, that divide, that crossing of a divide, that their friendship is in some respects a surprising one. They have very, very different backgrounds, Jeep and Johnny. In fact, I think one of the most interesting moments in the entire novel is in one of the flashbacks from, I think, 18 years earlier, when Johnny's girlfriend at the time, who's had a little too much to drink and is speaking very freely, tells Jeep, Johnny's friend, quit trying to get in. It's not going to happen. You're always going to be signing the guest book, never a member. And I think you're really touching on something so interesting and also really potentially painful when you have people from different backgrounds who are drawn together, in this case, by athletics and other ties of friendship. But there is this divide that at certain points probably makes the friendship or even a relationship really, really tricky.
Absolutely. And thank you for that. And it is part of the key to this, is that even if you're friends with this person, or in Jeep's case with Johnny Chambliss, there's always going to be the sense in Jeep of, I'm actually on the outside with my nose pressed to the glass. I don't really know what the rules are of how to get into that party. And I probably never will. And his Johnny's girlfriend, Niven, points that out to him, in as you just quoted. And I think that in the world, most people walking around, it's based on money or class or ethnicity or any number of factors where you go, there's rules to those guys that I don't know. You know, there's a handbook that I'm never going to be shown. And that sets Jeep off. To investigate Johnny's what looks like an accidental death, but Jeep is pretty certain that it wasn't, he has to go and find that book and read it and figure out how these tribes, what their customs are, what their secrets are. And so that became the engine of the book that to me it was fun to write, because it wasn't just a police procedural. It was really a socioeconomic, how do you figure this out?
Hmm. One of the things that I think rings as especially authentic is the nature of this friendship and the way you have crafted the title character of Johnny Careless, who again comes from a very wealthy, privileged background. And there are things about him that are fairly stereotypical in terms of someone kind of blasting through life, following his own rules, often leaving a bit of mayhem in his wake, and certainly his friend Jeep would sometimes be left holding the bag in various incidents over the years. And yet you do not go quite so far as to paint Johnny in a way that makes him almost repulsive or a truly distasteful character. There is enough good in him and enough genuine appreciation for Jeep and others that make him a wonderfully complex character. How consciously careful were you about crafting the character in that way so he was not too much the villain here or the spoiled brat playboy who we would find difficult to like?
Right. Well, Thank you for that. And I think, and this goes for, it certainly went for writing for Blue Bloods and almost anything I've ever done. If there's a villain, if there's an antagonist, and there always is, you're better off creating someone with three dimensions where the audience goes, oh, I kind of understand this guy, you know? And because if you just paint someone in black, the audience or the reader loses interest. Oh, that's the bad guy. I don't need to know anything else. So it was very consciously trying to craft a guy that Jeep was friends with because Jeep felt like he understood where the kid came from and understood that what looks like privilege to everybody else can also be a handicap. That growing up with too much money and too much license means that you never develop muscles of your own.
Hmm. At one point, I don't remember who it is, but maybe it's just kind of the narrator saying about Johnny, he was an example of the silver spoon rich kid in the mansion on the hill who could have a good and humble heart. And I think one of the most tender moments in the book is when Johnny's dad is talking to Jeep at one point in the book and saying to him, Gwen and I have always been so glad that you've been in our son's life, that somehow he's made a good friend who could also be a ballast and a compass. That means the world to us. So often in stories like this, the rich parents are really clueless and are probably the last to appreciate how this sort of grimier guy from the other side of the tracks mattered at all and maybe mattered in a really important way in their son's life. And I just love the fact that you have painted Johnny's parents in more interesting colors than we often encounter in stories like this.
Well, thank you. Thank you for that.
So where do you see this novel and this story leading? That is, what ultimately was it like for you to craft this exciting novel? And do you find yourself hungry to maybe take Jeep Mullane into other stories after this?
I am. I always thought the coolest job you could have was Ian Fleming's. You know, he would... Once Cubby Broccoli and Albert Saltzman bought, I think it was Dr. No, was the first of the Bond movies that they made. And they basically said to Ian Fleming, we're going to buy everything you ever write. So you write them, and we will we publish them in partnership, and we will make movies out of them, which obviously they did. And Fleming would have his book contract. He'd go off to Jamaica. He'd write the book and then return to London and do the publicity and the publishing and all. And I just thought, if you had a character that you enjoyed writing and you could every year put him in a different circumstance, but he would be good company to a league of readers who were looking forward to his next adventure, that seemed like a really cool job. Michael Connelly has it. Robert B. Parker, John D. McDonald famously had it with the Travis McGee series, and lots of very, very wonderful writers find a character that they can see the world through. And so I enjoyed doing Jeep, and if I had the encouragement and the time, I would do another one and another one after that.
This novel, again, is titled Johnny Careless. It is published by Celadon, which is a division of Macmillan. The author, Kevin Wade. Kevin Wade, congrats on all of the success that you have enjoyed, and particularly the success with this, your first novel, Johnny Careless. And thank you for being my morning show guest today. It was fun to speak with you.
Thanks so much. It was a pleasure being with you. I appreciate the invitation.
You're listening to the Thursday Morning Show on WGTD. I'm Gregory Berg. For part two of today's program, we're going to be hearing about yet another fine novel in an interview recorded and initially broadcast back in 2009. I am very excited now for the next few minutes to be speaking with someone who has 11 New York Times bestsellers to his credit and a marvelous new book called Proof Positive. The author is Philip Margolin, who has in his background a career as a criminal defense attorney and an experienced one at that, and he draws upon that so effectively in writing these marvelous works of fiction. And this most recent is absolutely no exception at all. And it calls to mind some of the programs which are especially popular on television right now, which draw upon forensic evidence. And this book helps shine a light just on how critical a difference it can be made when such evidence is used and or misused. Proof Positive is published by HarperCollins, and Philip Margolin, we welcome you to the morning show.
Thanks for having me on.
I have really enjoyed reading Proof Positive. One of the things that's really interesting about it is that you help us kind of step inside the mind and heart of an attorney, in this case a defense attorney by the name of Doug Weaver, who through much of the book is sort of anguishing over a case which he mishandled, which in effect led to the death, the execution of someone who continued to profess his own innocence. I imagine, even if you never experienced exactly what your character Doug Weaver did in your own career, that you still are somehow acquainted with that side of this kind of work, the enormous mantle of responsibility which this kind of attorney has to bear.
Well, I practiced for 25 years, and I did 30 homicide cases, and about 12 of them were death penalty cases. And the pressure on you when you're representing somebody and you know that if you mess up, the person's going to die is pretty amazing. If you're doing, let's say, a shoplifting case and you really, really screw up, the worst that can happen to the person maybe is they'll spend a couple of days in jail. But if you forget to dot one I in a memo, you know, there's this possibility always hanging over your head that the person can be killed. So I try to put that feeling that you have in the book, try to communicate with people the pressures that defense attorneys are under, because I think when you see on TV a lot of times or in a lot of the books, the defense attorney is pictured as a selfish, money-grubbing, immoral type of individual. And you know, my experience in real life is that that doesn't really reflect what criminal defense attorneys are like, and certainly doesn't reflect the type of emotional pressures that they're under.
Let's talk a moment about one other thing about this character of Doug Weaver, this defense attorney. And that's the fact that even quite apart from this very troubling case, which is from his recent past, in which a client of his was found guilty and was executed. But just in general, his career is not going particularly well. And he kind of looks around at the modest office in which his practice is housed and compares it to some of the high flyers who are so much more obviously and impressively successful. And I imagine that's another side of this whole law field that maybe the general public doesn't think about so much as well. But it's competitive nature in that kind of way, and that sense that maybe someone might be successful in one respect, but not in all respects.
Yeah, I mean, there are many different areas of law that you can go into. The ones that deal with business, the big Wall Street firms, for instance, or the large civil firms, their offices tend to be very grandiose, and you know they've got the view of the river and that type of thing, but a lot of times, that type of law doesn't really feed the soul. I mean, you're making a lot of money. You've got the trappings of success. But I think working with people, like I did as a criminal defense lawyer, we're actually working one-on-one with a human being to solve a problem doesn't necessarily pay as well, but there are other rewards that you can get from that type of work. For instance, I had two people that I was hired to represent after they had been convicted of murder and sentenced to life in the penitentiary. And I found to my horror that both of these guys were factually innocent. And it took me about 4 years in each case, but I was able to get them out of prison. And, you know, if I had a choice between, you know, working in a hovel and doing that type of work or having a very extravagant, gaudy office, but just never even meeting a client, I think it's a pretty easy choice for me as to which I'd take. And that's what I actually did do for 25 years.
We're speaking with Philip Margolin, and we're talking about his new book called Proof Positive. At the heart of this marvelous story is the relationship between Doug Weaver and a new client of his, a man by the name of Jacob Cohen, a really tragic figure. At one point you say, Jacob Cohen was definitely crazy, but also terrified and lost in a world that overwhelmed him. You say Doug Weaver's heart went out to his new client. Tell us a little bit about the sad story of Jacob Cohen, which you crafted here.
Well, in the book, Jacob is a paranoid schizophrenic. He's a homeless person who lives in an abandoned car in a vacant lot. And main focus of Proof Positive is on the dark side of CSI. What would happen if a person at the crime lab, instead of trying to use his scientific skills to find out who really committed a murder, decided to frame people because he felt that they deserve to be convicted. And Bernard Cashman is the sort of the star, even though he's the villain of this book. And he is a forensic expert at the crime lab, and he feels that he's almost like a god. And if a detective feels someone committed a crime but doesn't have the evidence, he makes up fingerprints and ballistics evidence. And he eventually becomes a murderer himself and needs to frame somebody for the murder that he committed. And he picks on poor Jacob, who has a very, very troubled past and is so crazy that anyone who sees him would assume that he's quite capable of killing a woman. And he's incapable, really, of defending himself from the real world because he lives in a fantasy world. So Cashman uses his forensic skills to set up a murder scene to make it look like Jacob committed this horrific dismemberment murder.
And if we should maybe mention that what makes Cashman such a compelling figure is that although he is doing terrible things, there is something almost noble, not noble, but almost noble about his motivation. I mean that it appears, at least in many cases, that he so fervently believes that this is someone who has done wrong, terrible wrong, but has maybe been let off on a technicality or something and needs to be taken off the streets. I mean, that is his mission in life, to do exactly that.
Yeah, and he's one of my I've had a couple of really good villains in my books, but he's one of my favorite villains because he, unlike a serial killer who just maybe kills for the pleasure of seeing someone in agony, Cashman believes that he has a mission to make sure that justice prevails. And but he's really crazy too, and his whole everything he does is perverted because he will decide that someone is a bad person, whether they are or not, and will then justify what he does on the grounds that he's ridding society of criminals.
At one point you say the people of Oregon were safer because he had acted decisively to protect them. He would drive home content and sleep the sleep of the just.
And he's
thinking this in the wake of, as you say, having just committed a horrific crime in order to silence a colleague who was about to blow the whistle on some of these illegal practices. In fact, I thought it was interesting, one of the main sections of the book you title Science Fiction. And I guess that's a really nice, succinct way of saying what really drives this whole story is the terrible possibilities when science, and specifically forensic science, is twisted in order to fabricate untruth rather than seeking the truth.
And one of the things that was the most fun for me about writing this book was learning how you can fake fingerprints, ballistics evidence, blood spatter evidence. When I was practicing, I used to really enjoy cases that had scientific evidence in them, because it's like going back to school. I'd have to learn things I didn't know anything about. And whenever the Oregon State Crime Lab or the FBI Crime Lab had a witness, had a witness on the stand, I always really just assumed that they were trying to give an honest opinion, even though I might have my own expert who disagreed with their conclusions. And about 8 or 9 years ago, I started reading these articles in the newspaper about people around the country who worked in crime labs, who were CSI, crime scene investigators, who were lying on the stand, actually fabricating evidence. Fortunately, it's a very small percentage of most of the people working crime labs are extremely honest, but there is a small, very small group of people, and they can create havoc by framing innocent people and sending innocent people to jail with testimony that's either fabricated or false or making mistakes and not admitting they're making mistakes.
One of the things that you do in this book is you essentially don't make it a mystery. I think I understand this correctly, in that we know everything that has happened. I mean, we know what's happened and who did it. That does not remain shrouded in mystery. What really is the big question, which keeps us turning the pages faster and faster, is wondering if Mr. Cashman Forever is ever going to be caught, and if so, how?
This was really a very different departure. In my first 11 books, there was always a mystery to solve, and usually, there'd be several people who could be the killer, and you wouldn't know who really did it until the very end of the book, and then hopefully for the reader it's a surprise. And I decided to make a departure just for fun, for myself, and hopefully for the reader, by letting the reader know very early on that Cashman is really, really messed up, and then actually showing him committing a murder, so we know that he did the killing. But he's so brilliant, and he's so clever, that he's always two steps ahead of everybody, and every time you think that there's some way that they're going to catch him, he figures out a way to skate away from the problem. So, and I'm glad that it worked for you, because that's really what I was trying to do with my readers in this particular book, is let them know who did it, but then have a guy who's so smart that he's always two steps ahead of everybody else, and have you wondering, are they ever going to get this guy?
Well, and I guess what is especially fascinating is that specter of someone who is within this system and someone who works within that process by which evidence gets gathered. I mean, that's what makes this person such a dangerous figure, because he's at the heart of it all. It's sort of the ultimate insider, or it's an inside job, and he is able, in effect, to sort of poison some of the efforts which otherwise would bring evidence to light, which would reveal what he's doing, because he's part of this law enforcement evidence gathering force that makes him especially dangerous.
Yeah, and at one point he even thinks when he's trying to decide whether or not to murder this colleague who has figured out that he's been messing around with the evidence in a couple of cases, he's going over the pros and cons the way you would, you know, should I buy this cereal or buy that cereal? And one of the things he thinks about is that, of course, he'll have an advantage over the average criminal because he's going to investigate the murder himself. So if he does leave some trace evidence, a hair or something that could incriminate him, when he goes to the crime scene, he'll find it and he can just get rid of it.
One of the things that's interesting is that some of the moments of most brutal violence in your book, and I'm thinking especially of those moments involving Mr. Cashman himself, but there's also some violence involving rival drug organizations sort of offing each other.
Mm-hmm.
It's interesting how you write about those moments. In a sense, very graphically, but not going on and on and on. You write very cleanly and almost matter-of-factly about some of those moments. It seems like it's very much in keeping with the way these people would sort of view what they were doing with a minimum of anguish and regret, and it's a job they feel that they have to do.
Well, there's a couple of things working there. First, you know, I try to not have too much or try not to have gratuitous violence, because I really don't like gratuitous violence or gratuitous sex for that matter, because I just think the more you show, the less the reader uses his or her imagination. And so with the violence scenes, unless it's really necessary to the plot, and there is one pretty gruesome scene in the book, but it's absolutely essential to the plot because it shows how, you know, Cashman creates a crime scene to frame someone. But where it's not really necessary, I'd rather just sort of suggest what's going to go on. And when I'm watching a movie, some of the scariest movies I've ever seen, for instance, Psycho, the scene in the shower, that classic scene, Hitchcock never really shows the knife touching the victim's body at all. It's all in your mind. And I feel that it's better to just cut away from a scene before something really bad happens, because if you go on and graphically show the violent scene, it may not be that big a deal for some readers. But if you cut away, the reader will use their imagination to imagine the worst thing that could happen, and they'll scare themselves. So they sort of do the work for you.
Hmm. I think of at least two different examples where someone is murdered, and in both cases, and it's probably even more often than that, I mean, the moment that, in fact, this person gets murdered you will sometimes just write those very simple words. And then he was killed, and it was seconds before he died. And, mm-hmm. and that's it. I mean, not sort of thrashing around verbally to give us that moment when someone actually dies. Something about that kind of matter-of-fact nature is especially chilling, and it helps us understand how some people in our society view these kind of acts.
Well, I actually, you know, hung out and did lunch with sociopaths, murderers, rapists for 25 years. It's sort of strange because most people never come in contact with the type of people that I represented, and it did really sort of give me an insight into how people who commit crimes think, and they do think about life differently than the way we do. And I think one of my big breakthrough book, Gone But Not Forgotten, I tried to create the worst human being possible and show the way that sociopaths like serial killers, Ted Bundy type of person, looks at life. And when I went on my book tour, people were coming up and saying that the book was just scaring the dickens out of them. This has been going on for almost 10 years now. People will come up and tell me, I read that book, I couldn't read it, you know, I was by myself at home, I couldn't read it. I got nightmares, and for a while I couldn't figure out why they were getting so nervous, because I didn't write the book intentionally to be scary, but it really does freak people out. And it slowly dawned on me that the reason that it was scaring people was because I was showing them the way these sociopath, psychopath thinks about life, and it's so different. And for me, it was sort of normal because I was hanging out with these guys every day. But for the average citizen, they just don't come in contact with this type of person.
Hmm.
So you know, being a criminal defense lawyer for 25 years is helpful for my writing in certain areas.
Well, fortunately, the pages of this book are populated with some good human beings as well. I mean, even someone like Attorney Doug Weaver, who's certainly has his flaws and is not sort of the typical heroic figure, but a admirable figure trying to do well. And you have other characters too, including an attorney who shows up from one of your previous books, Wild Justice.
Yeah, and actually also in Ties That Bind. Amanda Jaffe has the lead role in Wild Justice and in the second book, Ties That Bind. And she works with her father, Frank Jaffe, who's a top, they're both top criminal lawyers. It's a father-daughter partnership. And I'd always had in the back of my head that I'd really like to have a book where Amanda and Frank both have murder cases that don't appear to have anything to do with each other, but eventually they find out that there is a link, and that's what I've done in Proof Positive. I've got Frank representing this mob enforcer who's accused of the murder of a junkie, and Amanda working with Doug Weaver on this case where they're defending Jacob Cohn on this horrible dismemberment murder, and both of the clients appear to be guilty of sin, but they both insist that they're absolutely innocent. And of course what ties the two together is the fact that Cashman is the forensic expert, the CSI, on both of the cases, and he's phonied up the evidence in both of them. And as you mentioned before, you know all this stuff early on, so it's not a big, I'm not ruining any of the surprises for the reader, but it's how Amanda, Frank, and Doug Weaver figure this stuff out, and then what, you know, their attempts to try to do something about it when there's really no way in the world that they can prove that Cashman's been, you know, committing these crimes by phoning up the evidence. And that's where the fun sort of comes in.
Absolutely. And the tremendous suspense. The book, again, is called Proof Positive. It's published by HarperCollins. Philip Margolin, I love this book, and I'm really glad we got to talk about it today on The Morning Show. Best wishes with all of your future writing.
Thanks an awful lot.
Tomorrow on The Morning Show, two really interesting interviews. The first will be with Wayne Scott, the author of a very intriguing memoir called The Maps They Gave Us, One Marriage Reimagined. In part two of tomorrow's program, we're going to preview for you Sunday afternoon's concert by the Bell City Brass Works under the direction of Doug Johnson. And the theme will be Irish music in honor of St. Patrick's Day on Monday. Speaking of Monday, on The Morning Show, I look forward very much to welcoming to the program for the very first time State Representative Tip McGuire from Kenosha. The Morning Show airs every weekday morning between 8 and 9 o'clock. The Morning Show archive is found on our website, WGTD.org. And don't forget about the podcast version of The Morning Show. Look for The Morning Show with Greg Berg. This is WGTD HD, Kenosha, Racine, Elkhorn, and Lake Geneva.